It's you. You're the one who's sleeping with Zach. The one person I chose to confide in, ironically. He's 42 years old, Carson. He's my sister-in-law's husband. Carson stands, and Willa is afraid she's going to walk out. That would be a very Carson thing to do, drive off without another word. Don't run away, you coward.
I'm a coward, Carson says. You're the one who married your childhood sweetheart.
Don't change the subject, Willa says. I want to hear you admit it. You're having an affair with Zach.
Carson says nothing.
You realize that's disgusting and immoral?
Willa steps right up to her sister and lowers her voice.
Mom would be so disappointed in you. You're dishonoring her. You're disrespecting me. You're destroying the family that I'm trying to hold together.
Carson screams. Not everything is about you, Willa. Willa slaps Carson hard, right across the face. Carson doesn't flinch.
You know nothing about what happened with Zach and me, Carson says, and if I explained it to you, you still wouldn't understand. Because you aren't a human being. You're a robot, a housewife robot, whatever those are called. You're miserable in your life because you can't grow a baby, so you make yourself feel better by judging everyone else.
I'm judging you because you're my sister, and you've been screwing things up your entire life as a cry for attention, and so people would look at you and tell you how pretty you are.
Ah, Carson says, now we're getting to the real issue. You're jealous of me. Again, Willa slaps Carson hard, so hard her hand stings. She can't believe the fury that overtakes her. She's trembling. Her ears clog, her eyes water. She pulls her hand back to hit Carson again, and Carson grabs Willa by the forearm and pushes her away. Willa steps backward, and her foot gets caught in the hem of her skirt. She tumbles down the deck stairs.
Oh no, she thinks. No.
Vivi.
Go,
Martha says. Vivi swoops down, both hands in front of her pushing through the membrane. She isn't able to catch Willa exactly, but she shifts her so that instead of landing hard on the flagstones in front of the outdoor shower, Willa lands in the sand. Vivi senses a movement in Willa. It's the baby. He's jarred for a moment, but then he settles back into his bubble.
It's a he, Vivi thinks, and he's fine.
Willa is crying, but she rises easily.
You idiot, she says. I'm pregnant.
Oh my God, Carson says. Will. She helps Willa up the steps to the deck, and they sit side by side on the bench, hugging and crying.
I'm sorry, Willie. I'm so sorry. I had no idea.
Willa tries to catch her breath. She hit her hip on the step. There will be a bruise.
Thank God she landed in the sand. It could have been so much worse.
Carson says, it's over between me and Zach. It ended the same night I got fired, and I haven't contacted him since, and I haven't had a drink or a toke or a bump or a pill since then either. Willa excuses herself to go to the bathroom. She checks to make sure there's no bleeding. She looks in the mirror and says,
I'm okay. I'm okay.
Her voice is filled with relief and gratitude, and she casts her eyes upward. Vivi, meanwhile, is a mess. She sobs into Martha's Hermes scarf, which Martha is generously offering as a handkerchief.
That was so close, Vivi says.
Yes, Martha says.
I'm having a grandson.
You are.
But I failed as a mother, Vivi says. My girls hate each other.
She peers down at Willa and Carson, both now sitting at the picnic table in silence, opening their takeout containers. Peace has been restored, but Vivi knows it's only temporary. When Carson was born, I felt so happy that I had given Willa something she would have the rest of her life, a sister. Martha sighs.
Being sisters doesn't mean being best friends for everyone, Vivian.
Are you ever going to tell me what happened between you and Mary Beth? Vivi asks. And how you happen to have all these scarves? Martha closes her eyes briefly. I suppose August is drawing to a close, she says, which means our time together is almost over.
No,
Vivi says. Yes, Martha says. She shakes the scarf out and methodically smooths it, then folds it. Would you like to hear the story? Yes, Vivi thinks. Martha sits on the velvet chaise, props her feet up on the coffee table, and pats the spot next to her. Vivi sits. Out the open side of the room, they have a spectacular view of night settling over Nantucket. A navy blue sky shot through with streaks of brilliant pink. Mary Beth was 4 years younger than I, Martha says. She was, you might say, the Carson to my Willa. Not exactly, of course, but close enough. My husband, Archie, was a boy Mary Beth and I grew up with in Kalkaska, Michigan. So I am a bit like Willa because he was my first love, my only love. Archie and I both attended the University of Michigan. In my senior year, I received a job offer from FedEx, and after graduation, I moved to Memphis. Meanwhile, Archie went to medical school at Michigan. We decided on a long-distance relationship. Well, the year I left for Memphis was the year Mary Beth enrolled at U of M, and she and Archie started a secret relationship. Vivi instantly perks up. Oh my. I had no idea, Martha says. It went on for 4 years. But it couldn't have been too serious, because when Archie finished medical school, he took a residency at St. Jude's in Memphis. He was in pediatric oncology, and St. Jude's is, of course, one of the top hospitals in the country for treating and researching childhood cancers. Archie proposed to me. We were married. Mary Beth graduated with a degree in theater and moved to New York to become an actress. But she ended up marrying Richard Schumacher, a man who was much, much older than her and very rich. He owned a brownstone on East 78th Street, a house on Nantucket, and a sailboat named Windcastle. Right, Vivi says. She remembers Mary Beth talking about her home in Shakimo Hills and her boat. Archie and I met Richard for the first time at their wedding, Martha says. They got married at City Hall, and Archie and I flew in to be witnesses. We went to lunch afterward at Le Cirque. It was very chic, exorbitantly expensive, and it became clear at that lunch that Richard didn't care for Archie one bit. He was rude to Archie throughout the meal. Martha clears her throat. I have my suspicions now that Richard knew, as I did not, that Mary Beth and Archie had had a love affair. It's interesting, Vivi thinks, that Martha calls it a love affair and not a fling. Just wait, I'm getting there, Martha says. Archie and I barely saw Mary Beth after that. We were never invited to New York or Nantucket, though, of course, Mary Beth would send me your books, so I felt like I'd been there. Vivi decides to take this as a compliment. And then one winter, Richard slipped on the ice on the sidewalk in New York, broke his hip, and died shortly thereafter. The following summer, Mary Beth invited us to Nantucket. Martha rests her head back against the chaise, and Vivi follows her gaze up to the lacy pattern of light on the ceiling. We had a magical week. We drove onto the beach at Great Point with magnums of Veuve Clicquot. Mary Beth made a joke about the Merry Widow, and we grilled lobster tails and little neck clams on the hibachi. We walked through the moors, visited Bartlett's farm, rode bikes out to Sconset during the first bloom of the cottage roses. We ate at the boarding house and the company of the cauldron. We sang at the piano bar of the club car. We did all the things the people in your books do. Wow, Vivi says. All this time, she had no idea that Martha was a fan. She feels honored. We went for an all-day sail on Windcastle. That boat had a captain and a mate and a chef who prepared lunch, but Mary Beth liked to play bartender. She was making her signature cocktail, which she called the Bad Decision. Vodka, St. Germain, and fresh-squeezed grapefruit juice with a champagne floater. Well, I had 5 or maybe 6 bad decisions over the course of the afternoon. As the boat rounded Abrams Point and we could see Mary Beth's house in the distance, Mary Beth said she was going to swim the rest of the way in. Not to worry, she did it all the time. Her captain would take care of the boat. Martha pauses. I made my own bad decision to join her, and Archie wasn't about to be shown up by the two of us. We had all grown up together on Lake Michigan, don't forget. Those two dived in ahead of me and off they went. I almost didn't go after them, but in the end, I didn't want to be bested by Mary Beth. I was much drunker than I realized, and the water was choppy, and I hadn't swum in open water in decades, and it was much farther than I anticipated. I became exhausted and started swallowing water, and I was dragged under for periods. I tried calling out and waving to Windcastle, but it was so far away that it was useless. Martha stops. Vivi is holding her breath. Those two made it to shore, and I drowned. Vivi whispers, I remember hearing that story as gossip, but it was never in the paper, and I had no idea it happened to Mary Beth's sister, though, come to think of it, I hadn't seen Mary Beth in a while. When did this happen? In 2019, Martha says. Mary Beth saw to it that it was kept quiet, and then 6 months later, she married Archie. You're kidding. I was brought up here to the beyond, and my person, Jerry, gave me one nudge. Only one? Vivi says. The policy changed back in January, Martha says. Used to be 1, now it's 3. You got lucky. What did you nudge? Vivi asks. Didn't you want to stop Archie and Mary Beth from getting married? I tried, but I couldn't, Martha says. Turns out they were in love. They'd been in love for decades, and nudges can't change that. Ah, Vivi says. So, instead? Instead, I reached down and disappeared Mary Beth's collection of Hermes scarves. Martha holds the silk square out, Exhibit A. She thought she was robbed. You were allowed to bring the scarves up here? Vivi asks. Martha shrugs. Jerry was a progressive. Vivi marvels over this story. She thinks, well, what she thinks is that it would make one hell, oops, heck, of a novel, and it falls right in Vivi's wheelhouse. The swan dive, she would call it. But before Vivi can ask Martha what she thinks, could she write a novel and distribute it, maybe to the angels in the choir? She turns to find that Martha is gone. Leo. In 1 week, Leo's father and Savannah will drive him out to Boulder. They're taking the route Vivi mapped out, and they're stopping at all the places Vivi chose. Savannah found the itinerary in the notes app of Vivi's phone. It'll be kind of like your mom is with us, Savannah says. I have her playlists and everything. Kind of like is just another way of saying nothing like, in Leo's opinion. He has lost so much this summer, and although a part of him is ready to move on, get off the island, start a life somewhere new, he knows he has unfinished business. Marissa has a list of things she wants to do before they both leave for college, and sleeping out on the beach at Matakishem is the only thing left. Marissa has some romantic vision of a bottle of wine, a couple of sleeping bags, and a sky filled with stars. And although Leo goes through the motions of preparing for this outing, he has no intention of sleeping on the beach. He's going to live his truth. When he picks Marissa up, she's subdued. And when he asks what's wrong, she says that she had an unpleasant phone conversation with Rip Bonham about her claim. He thinks I'm lying about the timing of my accident, she says. Technically, it wasn't an accident. Leo says, you drove into the bathtub on purpose. Shut up, Leo, Marissa says. Leo's anxiety is rising like the water level in a Titanic stateroom. It's going to drown him. He fights for a clear breath. He promises himself it will be fine. It's no big deal. He just needs to get to the beach and talk to Marissa calmly and rationally. The road to Matakeshem turns to dirt. They rumble along. Marissa suddenly starts to cry, but Leo can't engage. He can't get distracted. He realizes the song on the radio is Falling by Harry Styles, which was the theme song for their senior banquet. Is that why she's crying? It's an emotional time, the transition between one period of their lives and the next, leaving the cradle of this island, venturing into the wider world. For him, the Rocky Mountains, for her, the mansions and glamour of Newport. He wants to assure Marissa that she'll thrive without him. She's a smart and beautiful girl. She'll meet people, make friends, find someone who genuinely adores her. Leo has been pretending for years. That ends tonight. That ends now. He pulls up to the lip of Matakeshim Beach. It's the wild, windswept southeast coast, nearly always deserted at night. There are a few homes on the bluff, all completely dark. The owners have probably left for the season. Summer is ending. The waves crash under a nearly full moon, which makes the water look dense and metallic, like mercury. Marissa.
You don't want to sleep here, do you? She says. You look like I've brought you to the proctologist's office.
He wants to smile, but it's beyond him. We need to break up. He turns to face her. I'm not in love with you, Marissa. Her face looks ghostly pale in the moonlight, like an image on black and white film. She isn't wearing any of the orangish foundation she favors, and Leo thinks she looks prettier without it. He watches her absorb his words. A flicker of recognition ignites in her expression.
I know, she says.
You do? She pulls out her phone and with a few finger swipes, brings up the photograph. It's of Leo and Cruz kissing. Leo pretends not to remember the moment, but he does, vividly. Cruz was trying to load Leo into the car. Leo was drunk, protesting. When Leo twisted away from the open passenger side door, Cruz's face was right there, and an instinct, so long and so deeply sublimated, surfaced. Leo had grabbed Cruz's head and started kissing him. Almost immediately, there had been a flash. Cruz pulled back, and Leo made out the shadowy figure of Peter Bridgman, gawking at the image he'd captured on his phone. Leo had socked Cruz right in the eye. Get off me, Leo screamed. What the heck, man? Cruz said. He pulled off his glasses. One of the lenses was cracked. Get off me, Leo said again, louder, in case Peter Bridgman was still listening. Me get off you? Cruz said. Are you kidding me right now? Man, you're my brother and I love you, but not that way. Which Leo knew, which Leo had always somehow known. Cruz was the frick to Leo's frack. Cruz was his best friend, his ride or die. But Cruz was straight. Get off of me, Leo said. He stumbled away, thinking Cruz would persuade him to get back in the Jeep, but Cruz didn't. Cruz drove off, leaving Leo in the parking lot. Leo somehow made his way out to Eel Point Road, where Christopher, who was heading home, picked him up. Leo takes the phone from Marissa. Peter sent this to you?
He did.
So you knew? You knew all along?
I'd always suspected, Marissa says. Because your friendship with Cruz, your devotion to him was weird, Leo. It was unnatural. But even so, seeing this was a shock. All I could think was that you lied to me for years. A profound lie, Leo. She clears her throat. I tried to convince myself that I was overreacting, that you two were probably just kidding around. I mean, Cruz isn't even kissing you back.
Leo nods and hands the phone back to Marissa.
I know he's not. But we weren't kidding around. Or I wasn't.
His eyes are glossy.
I love him. I've always loved him. My whole entire life, I've loved him. But it was one-sided.
It's disgusting, Marissa says. Leo sits with this for a second. He's not sure if she means it's disgusting that he loves Cruz when he pretended to love Marissa, or that it's disgusting because it's two men kissing. It doesn't matter. Marissa has revealed herself either way. She has no feelings, no empathy, no ability to sense anyone's pain but her own.
I'm taking you home, he says.
He throws the car in reverse and fights the desire to leave her on the side of the road. He is not disgusting. He has finally spoken his truth. He loves Cruz DeSantis. After he drops Marissa off, he'll call Cruz, figure out where he is, and apologize in person. He will get it all out. His love, his denial, his shame, his rage, his sadness, his grief. And then, once he's an empty vessel, he can accept his heartbreak, accept himself, and start to heal. When Leo pulls onto Marissa's road, they see red and blue flashing lights. The police are waiting in her driveway. The chief. He had nothing for weeks, then everything at once. No sooner did Jasmine Kelly say the name Lopresti than the chief knew it was Marissa's sister, Alexis, who worked dispatch, and her new boyfriend, Officer Pitcher, who tampered with the evidence. They destroyed Vivian Howe's clothes. They paid Justin to plant the running shoes. Alexis wants to take all the blame. It was her fault, her plan. She had been able to persuade Pitcher because she had something Pitcher wanted. This is an old story, Ed thinks. Alexis was trying to protect her sister, Marissa. Marissa Lopresti is the one who hit Vivian Howe. The chief brings Marissa into the station and she spews forth the whole story. She and Leo Quinborough broke up at a bonfire at 40th Pole the night before the accident. Marissa then got cozy with Peter Bridgman. It was easy, she said, because Peter had had a crush on her since fourth grade. Marissa thought Leo would get jealous seeing her with Peter, but Leo disappeared. No one had seen him. Marissa blew Peter off and left the party, but Peter Bridgman lurked around, eventually catching Leo and Cruz DeSantis kissing by the side of Cruz's Jeep. The photograph, which the chief had suspected was of two people in a compromising position, was of Cruz and Leo. Okay, the chief thinks. He's a lot more woke, as Chloe and Finn would say, than he was 20 or even 10 years ago, but this possibility hadn't even crossed his mind. Clearly, he still has some evolving to do. Peter sent the photograph to Leo and Cruz in the middle of the night, but he didn't send it to Marissa until the next morning, right after Cruz woke Peter up by pounding on his door. Peter hadn't answered, not wanting a confrontation that his parents might hear. Peter Bridgman's phone records, which the Greek managed to subpoena, showed a text with an attachment sent to Marissa's phone at 7:14 a.m. Marissa says she was driving over to the Howe residence to see Leo and make up when she got a text alert on her phone. Because it was so early, she assumed it could only be Leo. She checked her phone and clicked on the photo as she was turning onto Kingsley Road. She had only glimpsed the photo. She said she wasn't even sure what she was looking at when she heard a sickening thud. She slammed on the brakes and realized she had hit a person. She had hit Vivi. She panicked, she said. There was no one on Kingsley and no cars on the Matticat Road. She backed up and drove west. She took the turn onto Eel Point Road. I had every intention of going back to Kingsley, Marissa said, but I just didn't. Alexis texted to say Vivi was dead and then She told me another officer had seen Cruz running a stop sign and speeding, and that Cruz had probably killed Vivi, and I felt relieved by that. I was angry at Cruz. By then, I had seen the photograph. So I drove my Jeep into the bathtub, and I told Rip Bonham at my insurance company that I'd done it on Friday night.
When the chief called Rip Bonham, Rip said he'd had doubts about Marissa's story all summer. According to the mechanic, the Jeep hadn't been submerged for as long as Marissa said it had been. He thought she'd been lying as a way to angle for insurance money, not to cover up a crime. Rip Bonham put Lisa Hitt in touch with the garage that was holding Marissa's Jeep. Luminol turned up Vivi's blood on the fender. "Every contact leaves a trace," Lisa Hitt says mournfully to Ed over the phone. "I can't believe how this turned out. It's like a
Vivian Howe novel,"
Ed says. As relieved as he is to close the case, his heart is heavy for all involved. He has joked many times about having job security. People will never stop making mistakes. But this isn't funny. Ed doesn't get home until noon the next day. He stayed up all night questioning people and filling out paperwork.
"Phones," he says to Andrea. "They'll be the death of civilization."
Andrea pulls Ed's phone out of his shirt pocket. "Leave yours right here," she says, plugging it in at the kitchen counter. "I got you the pastrami special from the Nickel. Then you're going to bed."
Vivi.
Vivi doesn't have to call for Martha. She's right there, the same red and gold scarf from the other day serving as a pocket square.
"Marissa hit me?" Vivi says. "Marissa killed me?"
"I'm surprised you didn't figure that out," Martha says. She checked her phone as she was turning and was just looking at the photograph of Leo and Cruz when she hit you.
Martha pauses.
"I'm surprised you didn't figure out about Leo and Cruz either." Since Vivi has been dead, her children have surprised her. It's true. But she is not surprised to learn that her son has romantic feelings for his best friend. The whole Howe Quinborough clan fell in love with Cruz, at least in part, because of the sterling quality of Leo's devotion for Cruz. When Leo was in preschool, he once drew a picture of himself and Cruz living in a house together, with smaller figures that were meant to be their children. The teachers at the school had chuckled about this, Vivi remembers, but at least they were open-minded enough not to tell him the picture was wrong. And Vivi, for her part, had taped it to the refrigerator. Vivi watches Leo's conversation with Cruz from a greater distance than she normally does. She wants to afford them some privacy. The conversation takes place on the back deck of Cruz's house the very same afternoon that Marissa speaks to the police. Vivi can't hear a word, but she can observe their body language. Leo, contrite, and Cruz, initially defiant, then softening into forgiveness. The boys end up in silence, sitting side by side, both bent over their knees with their heads in their hands. When Leo stands to go, it's unclear if they can still be friends. Leo heads for the side yard. It looks like he's leaving. And Cruz says something that makes him turn. Cruz opens his arms, and Leo walks back to him. The two boys hug for a moment. When they separate, they do a complicated handshake that they'd once tried unsuccessfully to teach Vivi. "You two are frickin' frack," she had said at the time. "I'm just the mom." Vivi listens in on Willa and Carson later that day when they meet in Vivi's kitchen over glasses of iced tea. They seem to share the same opinion for once. They're both furious. Marissa Lopresti had been her usual careless, thoughtless, irresponsible, entitled, needy self, and had picked up her phone instead of watching the road. She had become so absorbed in her own drama that she had hit Vivi, killed her, murdered her,
It's absolutely reprehensible. She will never be forgiven.
Vivi takes a deep breath.
A part of her agrees that Marissa deserves little in the way of mercy. She robbed Vivi of the chance to watch her children grow up, meet her grandchildren, write more books, swim in the ocean, eat a tomato sandwich on perfectly toasted Portuguese bread, to meet a new man, make love to that man, maybe break up, maybe get married again.
Vivi would never again clink her wine glass against Savannah's at the end of a long week. She would never again fall asleep while reading, or take an outdoor shower, or laugh at a commercial during the Super Bowl, or marvel at a sunset.
"And as if that weren't egregious enough," Willa says, "she drove off. She plowed her Jeep into the bathtub and lied to my husband in an attempt to cover her tracks. Then she tried to pin it on Cruz.
She hung out at our house all summer long as though nothing was wrong," Carson says. "She made a Bakewell tart like she was Mary freaking Barry come to the rescue. She's a complete sociopath.
She sat with us at Grammy's birthday dinner and none of us were any the wiser," Willa says. "The murderer was at our table."
"It was also Peter Bridgman's fault," Carson says. "Sending out that picture of Leo and Cruz? Girl, who does that? Who cares? It's 2021.
"I'm going to choose to believe that Marissa hadn't seen the photograph when she hit Mom. She was driving too fast because she wanted to get to the house to talk to Leo, and she checked the text because she thought it was from Leo. It could have been from her mother or her sister or Verizon. I don't think we can pin this on Peter."
"But what if Peter knew about me and Zach?" Carson says. "What if that's why he was trying to gotcha Leo? Because he held a grudge against me, against our family."
"Marissa said Peter has had a crush on her since elementary school," Willa says. "I'm sure he wanted to show Marissa the picture because he wanted her for himself. It didn't have anything to do with you."
Carson gnaws her bottom lip. "I want her to go to prison."
"Oh, me too," Willa says. "But I can't help thinking..."
"What?"
"That after all is said and done, Mom would forgive her," Willa says.
They both sit quietly for a second.
"It was an accident," Willa says. "I mean, she didn't drive over to the house intending to kill Mom. And I've definitely checked my phone while driving."
"I've done worse," Carson says.
"I'm sure you have."
"It's by the grace of God I've never killed anyone," Carson says.
"Would you have run, though?"
Willa asks.
"Either one of us could have gotten distracted while driving and hit someone and killed her. But the test of our character, our morals, is whether we stay and admit to it or run away. Marissa ran away. And she pushed the theory that Cruz did it. She wagered that people would suspect Cruz before they'd suspect her. Which is heinous for so many reasons."
Carson says, "I would have been tempted to run. I'm not saying that's what I would have done, but I do understand the instinct."
Willa sighs. "So, we don't press charges?"
"She's being charged by the state," Carson says.
"But we could offer a statement of mercy," Willa says. "It might help."
"I just feel like we aren't honoring Mom unless we ask for the maximum sentence," Carson says.
"As usual, you have things backward," Willa says. "We honor Mom by offering forgiveness. You know how she treats the characters in her books? She gives them flaws. She portrays them doing horrible things. But the reader loves them anyway. Because Mom loves them. Because they're human."
"Like Allison in Golden Girl," Carson says. Willa is resting her hand on her belly. She takes another look at Carson.
"Wait. Have you been reading Mom's books?"
"I've had a lot of time on my hands," Carson says.
Vivi rocks back and forth, hands brought prayer-like in front of her heart, tears streaming down her face.
"I'm so proud of my girls," she says. "They came to that conclusion on their own. I didn't have to use a nudge."
"Which is a good thing," Martha says, "because you're out of them."
Nantucket. With the investigation closed,
The body of Vivian Howe is returned to Nantucket. The family gathers on the Friday of Labor Day weekend to bury Vivi in the cemetery on Milk Street. At some point, we know, this will become a popular pilgrimage for Vivian Howe readers across the country. They'll lay bouquets and seashells and pillar candles by the headstone. They'll take selfies of themselves in their Lily Pulitzer dresses and mystique sandals standing at Vivian Howe's grave. But for now, it's just the family and close friends. Rip and Willa Bonham have their arms wound around each other as they lead the way toward the gravesite. Willa has just had her 17-week prenatal appointment and ultrasound, and everything looks great. She has finally been able to share the news. She's pregnant with a little boy and due on February 11th. The elder Bonhams are over the moon, especially Tink. When Tink asks Rip if it would be appropriate for her and Chas to come to the burial, Rip asks Willa her thoughts. "Tell them we're keeping it small," Willa says, "and pass that on to your sister as well. She and Zach and Peter don't need to come." Carson attends the burial with Marshall Sebring, the bartender from the Field and Ore Club. Carson and Marshall have become something of an item. A few of us saw them out to dinner at Lola, and still others of us noticed them anchored off the second point of Coteau in a Boston whaler. When Dr. Flutie, a regular at the Field and Ore Bar, asked Marshall what he planned to do when the season was over, Marshall told Dr. Flutie that he and his girlfriend were going back to Portland, Oregon for a while. His girlfriend had never seen that part of the country. It might be just a visit, or if they can both find restaurant jobs, it might become something more permanent. Dr. Flutie says he's jealous. He may be old and a bit of a drinker, but even he knows the restaurant scene in Portland is top-notch. Leo attends the burial with Cruz DeSantis and Cruz's father, Joe. We're all happy to see that Leo and Cruz have made up and are back to planning Cruz's trip out to Colorado after his first quarter at Dartmouth. "We're friends for life," Cruz said when he and Leo reconciled. "Nothing's going to change that, man." Leo has a hard time shaking the feeling that the accident was his fault. When he went to his father and Savannah and told them everything, they assured him he had done the right thing in breaking up with Marissa. Her reaction to the news was beyond his control. "I should have broken up with Marissa a long time ago," Leo said. "I should never have been dating her in the first place. If I had just been truthful about things." Savannah gave him a squeeze. "You had nothing to do with it, Bear. Your dad and I are both proud of you and love you more than you will ever know. Your mom does too, I promise. The love doesn't go away. She's looking down on you every second of every day." Savannah is leaving for Manaus, Brazil, on Tuesday, and JP realizes how much he's going to miss her. He's had dinner at her house once a week since Vivi passed, and those are nights he looks forward to. More than a few times, he's found himself wanting to kiss Savannah, but he's held back because he's afraid of muddying the waters of their newly formed alliance, and he doesn't want it to be confusing to the kids. He would love to go with her to Manaus and volunteer, but it's still too busy at the cone for JP to travel. By the time Savannah gets back, summer will officially be over, and JP will be getting ready to close the shop. He'll make his move then, maybe. See what happens. Lucinda is attending the burial with Penny Rosen. "Someday that will be us," Lucinda says, nodding at the coffin. "Someday soon," Penny says. "I woke up this morning with the worst chest pain." "Well, for goodness sake, see a doctor," Lucinda says. "If something happens to you, who will I beat at bridge?" Penny smiles and decides not to tell Lucy that the tightness in her chest remains to this very minute, or that she has been having vivid dreams about her late husband, Walter. She knows that beneath Lucy's joke about the bridge, there's genuine concern. Penny will try to hang on for Lucy's sake. Maybe she's just hungry. Rumor has it that Joe DeSantis is catering the lunch after the burial. Joe's chicken salad with pecans and dried apricots in mustardy dressing is as good a reason to stay alive as any. Marshall Sebring of Gaston, Oregon, grew up with a mom, a dad, a sister, and a dog. A regular, happy American family. And although he wouldn't change a second of it, there's something about Carson's family that is fascinating in a way that Marshall's family is not. Her father, J.P., owns the Cone. Her sister, Willa, works at the Nantucket Historical Association. And her brother, Leo, just graduated from Nantucket High School and is going to the University of Colorado, Boulder. Then there's Carson's grandmother and Mrs. Rosen. They're two tough but elegant ladies. Marshall has served them dozens of times this summer at the club. And there's Savannah Hamilton, who founded Rise and whose family has owned their house on Union Street for something like 300 years. Marshall has just met Leo's friend Cruz and Cruz's father Joe, who owns Marshall's favorite sandwich shop, The Nickel. Marshall feels like he's standing in a cluster of real Nantucketers, people whose attachments to this island run as deep as tree roots into the soil of the island. The person Marshall really wishes he'd been able to meet, however, is Carson's mother, Vivian Howe. "She was magic," Carson told him. "But she was my mom, so I took her for granted. I didn't understand how lucky I was to have her until she was gone." Marshall decides when he gets home from the luncheon following the burial, he's going to call his parents and tell them he loves them. Lorna O'Malley drives past the cemetery on her way from the hospital to her apartment. The biopsy has come back positive for a malignancy. Lorna has triple negative intraductal carcinoma, a complicated way of saying breast cancer, at the age of 31. And although the news could be worse, she's still stage one, they caught it early, it could also be better. Lorna notices JP walking with Vivi's daughters. They're all dressed in dark colors, so they must have just buried Vivi. Lorna thinks about calling Amy to let her know that Vivi has finally been laid to rest, but she can't bring herself to think about death and burial right now. She'll call Amy later with her own news. "Pigeon," she'll say, "I'm about to lose me tits." Amy will cry about it, Lorna is certain. But she will shore up and become Lorna's person. She will go with Lorna to her appointments, share her Netflix password during Lorna's chemo, be in the waiting room during Lorna's surgery. She'll keep Lorna's mother back in Wexford calm, and she'll take Cupid for walks. After all the hours Lorna has listened to Amy chatter about JP, Dennis, and most of all Vivi, she'd better. Thinking this makes Lorna chuckle. At least she still has her sense of humor. Amy. On the Friday of Labor Day weekend, Amy and Dennis are enjoying the Raw Bar special at the Oyster Catcher. Amy had been purposefully staying away from the Oyster Catcher because she didn't want to face Carson at the bar. She couldn't imagine what Carson would think when she saw Amy and Dennis together. But then Amy heard from her client Nikki that Carson no longer worked at the Oyster Catcher. "You're kidding," Amy said. "What happened?" She felt a twinge of regret, quickly followed by relief, that she was no longer a part of the Quinborough family dramas. Nikki shrugged. "I'm not at liberty to say." "Something bad then," Amy thinks. Carson got fired, or got fired up and quit in a huff. The upside is that Amy and Dennis can return to the Oyster Catcher without feeling awkward. It's a festive scene. Everyone is out celebrating the unofficial last weekend of summer. Amy and Dennis order two rum punches and a dozen Island Creeks from a new, cute young bartender with a pierced nose. Dennis lifts his rum punch and says, "I'm taking you on vacation this winter. To the Caribbean. Maybe the Virgin Islands. What do you say?"
"I say yes."
Amy takes a sip of her drink and can already see the palm trees. If we were the subject of a Vivian Howe novel, what would the title be? She asks. The Leftovers?
I think that's already a book, Dennis says.
The Cast Asides? Amy says.
Dennis shakes his head with that look on his face that tells her he thinks she's crazy, but in the best possible way.
How about we just call it Love Story? He says.
I think that's already a book, Amy says.
Vivi.
They should call it The Rebound, Vivi says.
What Amy and Dennis have is more than just a rebound, Martha says.
It is? Vivi says.
Seriously?
She smiles. She finds she feels happy about this.
There's only one more chance for Vivi to travel back. She chooses Willa's wedding. It's June 13th of the year before. The weather is spectacular. It is, as Vivi's mother used to say, one of God's days. Vivi has abandoned her suspicions that Rip is not enough for Willa, and she now wholeheartedly embraces the union. Today, Willa is getting what she wanted since she was 12 years old and attended the Valentine's Day dance with Rip at the Boys and Girls Club. She's marrying the only man she's ever loved. Vivi has written about all kinds of love stories in her 12 novels, but she has never written about two people meeting in high school and making it work. Why not? She wonders. She thinks about Brett Caspian and the roller coaster ride of their romance. She has kept that story tucked safely inside of her for decades. But what if she brought it to the surface and used it? What if she wrote a novel about her and Brett? She decides to think about it later. Right now, she wants to focus on her daughter. Willa, Carson, and Vivi get ready together at Money Pit. Vivi has made a spectacular fruit salad. She went to the trouble of peeling 6 kiwis, even though nobody ever eats them. And right after her run, she picked up cheddar scones from Born and Bread. Only Carson eats. Willa is too nervous, Vivi too excited. Vivi opens a bottle of vintage Veuve Clicquot and makes mimosas with fresh squeezed juice. Willa is in her slip, her hair damp. Carson is giving Willa a chignon with braid. They all looked through thousands of pictures online and picked this style. And there's a gentleman named Rafe coming from Daria's salon to do all of their makeup. Lori Richards, the photographer, is due to show up any minute to take getting ready pictures. But right now, it's just Vivi and her two daughters. They're in Vivi's bedroom, which resembles a college dorm. Her mattress and box spring are on the floor. Her running clothes spill out of a jute basket by the side of a dresser she got at the Take It or Leave It at the town dump. The top of the dresser is littered with candles that Vivi lights for atmosphere. There are also receipts, pens, safety pins, a brush, half a dozen red lipsticks, and a pack of matches from 21 Federal, where she and JP went on their first dinner date. In other words, the room is a disaster. Vivi can't have Lori take pictures in here. Or can she? So many things in Vivi's life are works in progress. She will renovate this room eventually. She wants a round bed, some kind of cool light fixture, a boho chic vibe. But this moment is plucked straight from Vivi's dreams. Shawn Mendes is singing Treat You Better over the wireless speaker. Willa is an unapologetic top 40 fan and always has been.
My beautiful girls, Vivi says. She knows they'll both protest if she gets overly emo. But how can she help herself? Her oldest child is getting married. Her younger daughter is the maid of honor. Would someone please tell Vivi where the years went? It feels like she just brought Willa home from the hospital, just burst into tears because Lucinda said she loathed the name and JP had to explain that they, Vivi, had decided to name the baby after Willa Cather, the writer. First children are to be named after family, Lucinda said. Is Willa Cather family? What about the eternity Vivi lived through when Willow was a toddler, going to the children's house half a day and Carson was a baby? Then it felt like a second eternity when they were both small, Willa 6 and Carson 3, and Leo entered the world. The girls started battling for Vivi's remaining attention. There was name-calling and hair-pulling. Willa threw the remote control during an episode of Caillou and hit Carson above the eye. Stitches. Carson bit Willa during bath time and broke the skin. JP had joked about a rabies test, and Vivi, delirious with lack of sleep, had laughed. Vivi raises her glass, and the girls do as well. Through her tears, Vivi sees their three flutes come together. Shawn Mendes gives way to Lady Gaga. Vivi grants herself a moment of congratulations. She got her girls this far. Willa and Carson have always loved each other. And today, they like each other. "To you, Willie," Carson says. Willa smiles. She looks as beautiful as Vivi has ever seen her, without her hair done, without makeup, without wearing the ivory silk dress that hangs on the back of Vivi's closet door, because she is illuminated from within, lit by love. The florist has outdone herself with pink roses, pink lilies, and ivy. The bridesmaids are in blush, the groomsmen in navy blazers, Nantucket reds, and matching blush bow ties. There's a string quartet playing Pachelbel's Canon in D. As mother of the bride, Vivi is the last person to be shown to her seat before the processional. She's on the arm of Zach Bridgman, with Dennis following a pace behind in his too-tight gray suit pants. Zach seats Vivi and Dennis in a pew with Amy, who was escorted down just before Tink Bonham. Amy pretends to be absorbed in the program. When the bridesmaids come walking in, Vivi beams at the girls and winks at Carson, but she, and everyone else in the church, is waiting to see Willa. Jeremiah Burke's trumpet voluntary begins. Everyone stands and Vivi turns. Willa and JP appear in the entryway. There's a collective intake of breath throughout the church. Vivi quickly checks on Rip and sees his eyes shining with tears. He looks exactly as he should, as though there is no other woman in the world. There never has been, Vivi thinks with confidence, and never will be. After the ceremony, Willa and Rip climb into a horse-drawn carriage that will take them to the Field and Oar Club. All the guests are walking over except for Lucinda and Penny Rosen, who are being driven by JP and Amy. Dennis is busy chatting with Joe DeSantis, so Vivi links her arm through Savannah's. She has strolled the streets of town thousands of times, but today is the day of her daughter's wedding, so it feels distinctive. "So far, so good," Savannah says. "Everyone's being civil." She means Amy. She means Dennis. "Of course," Vivi says. "We're all adults." Vivi sounds a little more confident than she feels. The ceremony was the easy part. Vivi has reservations about the reception. She resents that JP insisted that Willa hold it at the Field and Oar, a club that didn't readmit Vivi after the divorce. JP and Amy will seem like the hosts when, in fact, Vivi is the one footing the bill. High road, she reminds herself. She prefers life on the high road. The Field and Oar throws a beautiful wedding. Vivi got married there herself. The family and the wedding party take pictures on the lawn. Vivi is wearing a peach silk slip dress, which is maybe a touch sexy for a 50-year-old mother of the bride, but it's nowhere near as attention-grabbing as what Amy has on. She's in an amethyst column dress with a neckline that plunges nearly to the navel and shows an eye-popping amount of skin. Amy seems to regret her choice of dress. She tugs and adjusts, smiles awkwardly, then tugs and adjusts some more. Eventually, she disappears, and when she returns, the neckline has been clumsily secured with a safety pin. Cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. Vivi takes mental snapshots. Savannah leaning forward as she slurps an oyster out of its shell so she doesn't drip on her dress. Leo, Cruz, Marissa, and Jasmine posing for a picture while Peter Bridgman lifts his mother's sea breeze off a table and takes a surreptitious sip. Tink Bonham laughing with Gordy and Amelia Hastings and saying, "I bet Willa will be pregnant by the end of the month." Dinner. The prime rib and Duchess potatoes are served with 3 spears of white asparagus and caramelized Brussels sprouts. The plate is garnished with nasturtium blossoms. Vivi nibbles on one. It's peppery. This wedding has taken a year to plan and is costing, yeah, a lot. Vivi leaves the dinner table to visit with people and make a pit stop at the bar. They're serving only wine with dinner, and Vivi wants tequila, specifically Casa Dragones. The club doesn't carry it, so Vivi dropped off a bottle earlier that morning. She has just received her glass when someone joins her at the bar. Zach Bridgman. "Maker's Mark on the rocks, please," he says to the bartender. To Vivi, he says, "First of all, gorgeous wedding. Thank you."
"You're very welcome," Vivi says.
"Second, I have a book recommendation for you. Have you read Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell?"
"It's on my pile," Vivi says. "I have one for you too."
Vivi sips her tequila and, instantly feels better. "Sea Wife by Amity Gage. It's told in split points of view. The wife and the journal entries of the husband." They're interrupted by Pamela, who is looking a bit severe in a high-concept black dress with an asymmetrical neckline and hemline. Frankly, it looks like a kindergartner took scissors to her dress.
"Trying to steal my date?" Pamela says. "You'd better keep an eye on your own."
"Wait," Vivi says. "What?" She peers into the ballroom to see Dennis standing with his wine glass aloft. He's giving a toast. Vivi can't quite hear him, but his wild arm gestures are alarming. Vivi sees Gordy Hastings, who is sitting at Lucinda's table, bow his head and frown at the napkin in his lap. Gordy Hastings, Vivi knows, is the person responsible for not letting Vivi back into the club after her divorce. She supposes he is now congratulating himself on that decision. "Dennis, sit down," she thinks. She hurries up the back stairs to the secret second-floor bathroom. Vivi had instructed Dennis to relax and have fun. There was nothing to be gained from going head-to-head with JP in the father figure department. What would make him think it was remotely appropriate to give a toast? She notices he waited until Vivi was away from the table. That can hardly be accidental. Vivi feels tears gather and she tries to calm herself. Today is Willa's day, not hers, and Willa might have been touched by Dennis's toast. Who knows? Vivi plucks a tissue from the box by the sinks and is carefully dabbing at the corners of her eyes, her makeup, when Marissa emerges from one of the stalls. Marissa is wearing a white lace dress that is vaguely bridal-looking.
"Are you okay, Vivi?" she asks.
She gives Vivi a concerned look in the mirror.
"Overcome," Vivi says. "I'm just so happy."
It's time for the first dances. Willa and Rip dance to Ed Sheeran's Castle on the Hill, and then the band leader invites the parents of the bride and groom to join the happy couple. Vivi knew this was coming, but she still finds she's unprepared. She has been giving Dennis the cold shoulder since getting back from the ladies' room, and she has no idea where he is now. She supposes she'll have to go find him. Tink and Chaz Bonham are already rising from their seats. Before Vivi can turn around to search the room for Dennis, JP approaches her with his arm outstretched. Plot twist, Vivi thinks. She had assumed JP would dance with Amy and that she would dance with Dennis. But this is better. This is correct. She and JP are Willa's parents. Vivi takes JP's hand, and once the two of them are on the floor, the band segues into Stay Together by Al Green, which is oh so ironic, and Vivi and JP fall into the familiar rhythm of their married dancing past.
Thank you, Vivi, JP says. This wedding is top-notch. Everyone has been commenting. And I couldn't have done it without you.
Or at all, Vivi thinks. But she just says, you're welcome. I'm happy for Willie and Rip.
Do you remember when we picked them up from the Boys and Girls Club after they went to the Valentine's Day dance together?
They were holding hands, Vivi says. I thought you were going to drop kick Rip out to the street.
Before he got out of the car that night, he kissed her, JP says. Their first kiss, and we were sitting right up front.
Do you remember what she said on the way home? Vivi asks.
She said she wanted to marry him, JP says. He takes a breath. And here we are, what, 12 years later? At their wedding.
We've been through a lot in those 12 years, Vivi says.
You wrote 6 more books, JP says, and I blew through 2 businesses before the cone.
Yes, first the yacht concierge business failed, then the wine shop, exactly as Vivi had warned him they would. Who had suggested an ice cream shop? Vivi. There were so many times Vivi felt she was the only engine moving the family forward. She dealt with the girls fighting, she took Leo off-island to lacrosse camp and fielded the call when he was homesick. She attended the parent-teacher conferences and read all the books the kids had been assigned for English class. When the family hamster, Mr. Busy, died, JP had been on a wine-buying trip, sipping Cabernets in Napa. And then you fell in love with your employee and you broke up our family, Vivi thinks. But she won't mention any of this because she prefers life on the high road. Al Green croons, loving you whether times are good or bad, happy or sad. Better memories swirl around Vivi then. JP sitting on the side of the bathtub holding out the ring box. JP in scrubs and a shower cap while Willow was being born. And then Carson. And then Leo. JP standing on a ladder outside the house in Surfside, stringing up the Christmas lights. JP and Vivi fretting when Leo spiked a 104-degree fever from a double ear infection. JP and Vivi sitting at the bar at 21 Federal, the night that Savannah insisted on having all 3 kids to the house on Union Street for a sleepover. She only made that mistake once. And then getting so drunk that they stumbled over to the Rose and Crown to sing karaoke. JP and Vivi watching the Patriots and high-fiving every time Danny Woodhead scored a touchdown. Sailing on Arabesque, watching fireworks from Lucinda's front yard, grilling on the beach at 40th Pole. Attending God knows how many cocktail parties where they would spiral away from each other to socialize, then spiral back to check in until one of them whispered, beat feet, their code for let's get out of here. They would always stop at Stubby's on the way home for fried chicken sliders and waffle fries. Whatever dress Vivi was wearing would inevitably get stuffed into the dry cleaning bag stained with ketchup. Speaking of the dry cleaners, Vivi thinks of the first moment she ever laid eyes on this man and how excited she'd felt. Finally, a cute guy her own age, there at the dry cleaners, Jackie Paper. JP notices Vivi gazing up at him, and he holds her a little tighter and bends down to whisper in her ear. Vivi, he says, I'm sorry. Ever so briefly, Vivi rests her head against his chest. The song is almost over. It's okay, she says. I forgive you. Martha shows up as the sun is setting on Monday afternoon. It's Labor Day, a day Vivi has always thought of as the saddest of the year. There are plenty of people on Nantucket who relish the sight of SUVs packed to within inches of the roof with luggage and trunks, surfboards strapped to the top, and bicycles hanging off the back, lining up to drive onto the ferry. But it fills Vivi with melancholy. These people are headed back to their real lives. Haircuts and school shoes, leaves to rake and burn, football games to attend. Kids are going back to college. Summer romances are breaking up. "Vivian," Martha says. She's once again in administrative mode, holding her clipboard, wearing her drugstore reading glasses. "It's time."
"You told me I could watch for the summer," Vivian says. "September is still summer."
"I said Labor Day, Vivian."
Did she? Vivi can't remember, to be honest.
"I don't want to go," Vivi says. "I want to stay where I can see my kids. I want to know they're going to be okay."
"You've given them everything they need," Martha says. "It's time for them to learn to live without you."
"But there are so many things left unresolved," Vivi says. "I want to know if Carson and Marshall stay together. I want to make sure Leo gets settled at college. I want to see if Savannah and JP hook up. Is Lorna going to be okay? And what about Penny Rosen? That chest pain didn't sound good."
Vivi swallows.
"I want to meet my grandchild, Martha. Just let me stay until he's born, and then I'll go without complaint."
"I'm not negotiating with you, Vivian.
I just need a few more chapters. Please, Martha."
How can Vivi possibly leave the green room with its parsley snips paint and fun striped wallpaper, a place that has been, if not heaven, then a haven where Vivi could still be a part of things? She can tell from Martha's expression that there won't be an extension, and so Vivi will have to draw on her faith. Martha has been both an angel and a shepherd. She has guided and advised Vivi well. She's an extraordinary person. Vivi couldn't have asked for better. Vivi thinks about how she likes to end her own books. She sets her characters down safely and walks away. She doesn't like to tie up every loose end neat and pretty with a bow. Even so, she's hesitant. "There are people in the choir you'll want to see," Martha says. Vivi highly doubts this.
"Oh yeah? Who?"
"Your father." Vivi sucks in her breath.
"My father is in the choir?"
"He is." She smiles. "Apparently, he has quite the baritone." Vivi's eyes blur with tears.
"Did he ever watch me?"
"He did," Martha says. "He even used a nudge."
"My father used a nudge with me?"
Vivi says. She would assume that Martha is kidding, but of course, Martha doesn't kid. Vivi racks her brain. Her father didn't keep her from lying to Brett about being pregnant. Her father didn't make her first novel an overnight runaway success, which could have happened back in 2000 if he'd nudged Oprah to take the Dune daughters with her when she went to Hawaii.
"What was it?"
Martha checks her clipboard.
"He made sure you went to college without any shampoo," she says.
"What?"
Vivi says. Then she gets it. Vivi had to ask Savannah for shampoo. She and Savannah became friends. Savannah took Vivi to Nantucket, where she met JP, got married, had 3 children, and wrote 13 novels.
"Yes," Martha says. "That's what we call a Rube Goldberg nudge."
"What about my mother?" Vivi asks. "Will I see her?"
"She does what I do," Martha says. "She's a person in the devout Catholic division."
"Ha," Vivi thinks. "Of course she is."
"You'll see her coming and going," Martha says.
"All right," Vivi says. "I'm ready."
She turns back to the open wall for one last look. Carson, Willa, and Savannah are sitting around the island at the Union Street house, designing Vivi's headstone. Vivian Rose Howe, 1969 to 2021. Mother, writer, friend. Underneath, they have chosen a Camus quote. "In the midst of winter, I found there was, within me, an invincible summer."
"Do you think it's too long?" Willa asks.
"It's perfect, Angel Bear," Savannah says. "Trust me. This quote defines Vivi."
"Yes,"
Vivi thinks.
Yes.
Is there any way I could come back from time to time? Vivi asks. Maybe check in on them?
What have I told you, Vivi? Martha says, never say never.
Never say never, Vivi thinks. This feels close to a yes.
Come along, Martha says, offering a hand. I'll walk you down.
Vivi clasps Martha's hand, and they head through the green door into a tunnel made of clouds. It's not so bad, Vivi thinks. It's pretty, peaceful. She's looking forward to the heavenly banquet.
I wish I could write a book about all of this, Vivi says. You, me, the beyond, the green room, the choir, the nudges, the Hermes scarves.
Martha shakes her head.
What about an Instagram post then? Vivi says. It can mysteriously appear on my feed. A picture of you and me with the caption, "It's all going to be okay."
Martha laughs.
Oh, Vivian, she says.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Golden Girl, a novel. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Produced and directed by Dennis Kao. Recorded by John Kovarik. Production supervised by Elise Green. Golden Girl is also available in print and digital formats from Little, Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2021 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2021 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.